Welcome to Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Zalewski from Condo Vultures. If you're tuning in to this podcast, you're going to hear a conversation by current and former journalists talking about some of the biggest stories that have occurred within the last week. These are stories that I handpicked. What are we going to be discussing in this episode, which is episode 6 of season 5? We're talking about requirements that the state of Florida is putting on condominium associations, new structural integrity reports, and the carve out cash to make sure there's money in reserves to actually fix this stuff. So that could mean in excess of $1 million a tower in terms of special assessments that could be coming down the pike if you're a condo owner. We're also going to talk about condo buyouts. Are they at risk? Some of these old buildings where they don't necessarily want to spend the money to fix them up, some of them might actually be forced to sell. But now there's been a legal decision that could actually reverse that entire thing. We're also going to be talking about Apple. Apple, not that fruit, but that technology company out of Silicon Valley. They're leasing 45,000 square feet of space in South Florida. We're going to discuss that. Another story we're talking about is the Federal Treasury moving close to 5%. And bond traders are starting to prepare for that. So we'll get into that. And what does that mean for mortgages? Because mortgages are based on the 10-year treasury rate. Another story we're taking a look at is the National Association of Realtors. They got jammed up with a lawsuit. They reached a settlement that's proposed. And what will it mean for the entire realtor industry? Some are calling it the survival of the fittest as we go forward. And then finally, we're going to wrap up the podcast with the dream of South Florida retirement. Is that dream dead because of all the changes that have occurred, as well as pricing, insurance costs, and a variety of other things? So the other side of the break, we're going to go ahead and get into our podcast.
Welcome to the CondoVultures.com podcast with your host, Peter Zalewski, a Miami real estate broker, Wall Street consultant, and expert witness. This podcast is focused on identifying real estate buying opportunities in the South Florida condo market of Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. The CondoVultures.com podcast is not authorized by the South Florida real estate industry and will most likely annoy many of the region's talking heads. This podcast will feature straight talk and salty language that could be offensive to some. Please remember that past investment success does not determine future gains, especially in South Florida's volatile condo market. For more information, please visit condovultures.com. Don't buy a South Florida condo, discounted or distressed, before taking a Condo Vultures correction tour. Condovultures.com offers weekly bus and walking tours that focus on educating buyers on the how-tos of identifying discounted condos, analyzing the opportunities, and purchasing units. Every tour attendee receives a list of all condo projects in a particular market, a market assessment handout, and unmatched expert analysis. For more information on the condo correction tours, please visit condovultures.eventbrite.com.
This is Peter Zalewski of the Condo Vultures podcast. I hope you're enjoying the podcast, and I wanted to alert you that if you have a property that you're looking to sell in the Tri-County South Florida area, I would encourage you to reach out to Jenny Cortez, a licensed real estate broker with CVRRealty.com. She's my partner. She's been in the business for north of 15 years. More importantly, she knows the market. She knows how to get a deal done. And she also realizes that it's more important to get a price that you can accept and sell the property rather than to hold firm on some price that's never going to be achieved and ultimately languish on the market. So if you're looking to do a deal that you want a skilled expert who can help you sell a property, reach out to Jenny Cortez at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859, or visit her website, CVRRealty.com.
Welcome to Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Zalewski of Condo Vultures. If you're tuning in to this podcast, you can hear a conversation by current and former journalists talking about some of the biggest stories affecting the South Florida real estate market, as well as the economy. The objective of the podcast is to cut through some of the fluff, some of the hyperbole that's out there, and give you, the audience, a straight talk perspective of what's really going on. I handpicked 6 stories. I sent them off to the journalists. I have 3 other journalists on the podcast with me. We're going to discuss the stories. Each journalist got 2 stories, and they're going to provide some expertise. So all that being said, let me go ahead and introduce you to the members of the podcast this week. We have a gentleman who was a journalist for over 25 years. Right now, he's on a public relations and marketing firm called Gruce Communications. No one else but John Gruce. If you want to check out John's website, go to grusspr.com, G-R-U-S-S-P-R.com. And you can get him on X, which is formerly Twitter, at John Gruss, J-E-A-N-G-R-U-S-S. What's up, Mr. Gruss?
Hey, Peter. Great to be back on the No Hyperbole Zone.
No Hyperbole Zone. 100%, John, 100%. Hey, I saw you over the weekend. We went to a Miami Marlins game versus the Atlanta Braves.
A lot of talk about inflation going up. From our experience, it was pretty damn cheap to go to that game. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, because I was with you. You are the master of finding deals.
That's true.
Deal finder.
I do like a deal. I do like a deal. So great to have you on the podcast this week, Mr. Gruce. Who else we have on the podcast? We have a gentleman who was a journalist for over 20 years, wrote in publications, including Software and Business Journal. Right now, he does public relations and marketing. No one else but John Fackler. If you want to get a hold of Mr. Fackler, check him out on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at JT Fackler, JTFAKLER. What's up, Mr. Fackler? And why didn't you go to the Marlins game with Sean, myself, and a bunch of others?
Well, I was invited, and unfortunately, I was not able to attend. And now I've been hearing how great a day it was from you for the last 24 hours. So great to be back on the podcast, though.
It's great to have you, Mr. Fackler. And if you want to see the foul ball I caught, just let me know. I'll be glad to share it with you.
I saw it. You already sent me the picture. Thank you. Just to make me even more jealous.
Fantastic. Fantastic, Mr. Fackler. Great to have you on the podcast again. And who else do we have on the podcast this week? We have our visiting journalist is the residential bureau chief for The Real Deal. No one else but Catherine Kalergis. You want to get a hold of Catherine. Get her on X, which is formerly Twitter, at K-K-A-L-L-E-R-G-I-S. What's up, Catherine?
Not much. I'm upset. I just found out I grossly overpaid for Marlins tickets.
Catherine, listen, there's always a deal to be had. It's like an airplane ticket. You just have to, you know, you have to search around.
And next time I'll call you.
Don't worry. It's not like Mr. Fackler. He actually missed out on it voluntarily. So, you know, it is what it is. It is what it is. So let me go ahead and lay out the rules of engagement before we go ahead and get into our podcast. If anybody has any questions for us, you want to comment, you can get us on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get us at Miami RRP, at Miami RRP, which stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. It's not AARP, but Miami RRP. And also, too, I want to tell you that the sponsor of the podcast is actually my firm, CondoVultures.com. CondoVultures.com. We pull statistics. We provide expert witness. We do consulting. We also get into brokerage and on the buy side if anybody's interested. So CondoVultures.com. So all that being said, let's go ahead and get into our podcast. As mentioned, I picked six stories. I sent them off to the journalists, two stories each, and then I'm going to ask each of them to go ahead and discuss it. We're going to go one story per journalist and just sort of rotate our way through the system. Mr. Gruce, John Gruce, we're going to go to you with the first story. This is actually coming out of the Palm Beach Post. I'll read you the headline first, couple graphs, and I want you to comment. Palm Beach Post, headline, what can owners do as the new state rules and insurance costs drive steep condo fee hikes? And let me give everybody some background. Back in 2021, there was a disaster in South Florida. There was a collapse of a condo tower called the Champlain Tower South. It's located in Surfside on the Barrier Island between the city of Miami Beach and the city of Sunny Isles Beach. Bell Harbor is also up that way. As a result of that, we've had some dramatic changes that have occurred in the state legislature, as well as to insurance prices and insurance fees. If insurance companies are going to go ahead and insure some of these associations, lo and behold, they're going to have to make sure that they're actually up to snuff, that these the board members of these associations are doing what's necessary. So legislation went forward, and now as of 2025, we're going to have some requirements that are suddenly put in place, and no longer can associations simply defer setting aside the money and dealing with the issues because of the disaster. Nobody wants to see that happen again. So this is a story sort of relating to that. So again, Palm Beach Post headline, what can owners do as new state rules and insurance costs drive steep condo fee hikes? Here we go, Mr. Gruce. And this story is basically an opinion columnist, a guest columnist that writes for the Palm Beach Post. People write in, ask questions, and then this gentleman sort of answers them. And here we go with the story that was written in. It says, this week, I wanted to remind everyone that on December 31st, 2024, deadline for condominiums to obtain structural integrity reserve study, or an SIRS, is fast approaching. For any budget passed on or after December 31st, 2024, the reserve funds mandated by this required report cannot be waived. That's going to amount to a huge sticker shock for many condo owners who've gotten used to waiving the reserves each year. The SIRS includes all the traditional big ticket items and also adds some items that may not have been covered in previous reserve studies. As a practical matter, this means that the bulk of your reserve will no longer be waivable. Mr. Gruce, it sounds like the state is actually going to force condo associations, which want to keep the maintenance fees low. Why? because this is not something you can write off from your income tax. And basically the money you burn on it, you're not getting it back. What does it go for? Make sure the building is safe and make sure you got a valet and make sure you got concierge. Swimming pool is clean, stuff like that. So what do you make of this? And what do you make of the looming deadline of January 1st of 2025?
Well, first of all, if HOAs have been doing their jobs, they probably wouldn't be in a pickle like this. If they're kicking the problems down the road and waiving every year the requirements to build up reserves, yeah, they're going to be in trouble. And I think it's just going to be on a case-by-case basis. I think fortunately there is an out for people, which is to sell their condos. I mean, we're still in a market where you can do that. I think especially as developers scout for condos to terminate and tear down and in good locations, I think there are going to be some opportunities for some of these condo owners to sell out. And they're going to, you know, especially if they're going to face a huge increase in fees.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. Mr. Griff, let me just go ahead and continue with one other part or portion that comes out of the opinion column, and then I'll open up to the floor. In it, it says, I've seen condominiums where this is predicted to add 6 to even 7 figures a year to the overall budget, a huge increase. Now, Mr. Griff, let's just kind of play this out. If you have your typical condominium community, let's call it 250 units. Yeah, ballpark. Many of them are north of 300. Some of the older ones, they're going to be less. Let's say it's 250 units. If you say it's $1 million is what's going to be added for reserves to go ahead and deal with some of these issues, you do some rough math. It's only about $4,000 a year or $1,000 a quarter, but that's in addition to what everybody's already paying because there's been tremendous surge in association fees basically since Surfside happened. And for what it's worth, I've been told by people who do property management that basically 30% of your maintenance fees, 20% will go towards insurance, and the other 10% is going to go towards property taxes. So what do you make of ballpark $4,000 in addition to everything you've been paying? Is that something that is going to be a game changer?
Well, if you're retired on a fixed income, yeah, that's a lot of money. And if you don't have the resources, particularly some of the older, much older buildings, say you've been in a building 20, 30 years, you retired here a long time ago, you're on a fixed income, Social Security, pension, and you have these huge increases in HOA dues and fees and special assessments. I mean, that's going to come as a bit of a shock. Some of the luxury condos, those buildings, I don't think are going to have the same issues, but it's going to be those older buildings that were maintenance has been deferred for years and years because HOAs don't want to upset the residents. You know, you get revolts anytime you want to increase fees. And so I think those older buildings with people on fixed incomes are going to be the first ones to really feel the impact.
Mr. Facker, you're a renter right now. Used to live in some condominium buildings. Some of them were on the older side. Well, what would you make of a $4,000 increase come 2025 and or roughly just doing some rough math there? What is that going to be, about $250 a month, $300 a month? What would you make of that? How would that impact or change or if at all your feeling about living in that condominium? Would you consider just paying it going forward because rents are still high? Or do you think that would be the last draw? Basically, you'd say, I'm out. I got to sell because I don't want to go through the work and the process it takes. You actually get the building up to snuff.
Right. And you want, not only want to sell, but you want to sell now because you want to make this move before the end of the year. We're already, you know, a third of the way into the year. So I other than that, you're going to be trapped. I see, you know, we'll be talking about this in my story later on the condo termination issue, but you know, you're really trapped. And the people that are there now that aren't fixed incomes are really trapped. But there's also the issue of newbies looking for condos. Are they going to, they're really going to have to look at whatever special assessments are there, any increases in tax rolls. You're going to have to make a decision. Is it worth it to even buy, you know, right now? So I see both sitting on the sidelines, you know?
Yeah. Interesting, Mr. Fackler. And for what it's worth, I said $250 to $300 a month. you're looking, I just did some rough math there, $333 increase a month based on that scenario I laid out, which was 250 units and $1 million, just to ballpark it.
Listen, a lot of these elderly people who've been living in these apartments, these condos for years, maybe only get $1,500 a month, $2,000 at most, as far as the Social Security. $300 a month is a huge increase. I mean, completely, it's almost unfathomable for them to be able to pay that money. So, you know, you got a lot of people in that range, that range of income.
Interesting. So, we're going to go on to story number two with this, Catherine Kalergis. She did a piece about condo termination. But before we go there, if I could just throw out, we've been running a lot of statistics. We're going up the coast. Everywhere in Dade, we're finishing up Broward. Now we're going to the Palm Beach County. What I can tell you is, generally speaking, we're seeing supply go higher and higher. It's still not in a crazy amount, but what's happening is you're seeing a real slowdown in terms of velocity of transactions. So you just wonder, as we go forward, as more and more people start to come to grips with what's coming in 2025, whether or not a lot of them are going to look to sell. And if they do, what will that do to pricing? So we can discuss that in the next story. So, Catherine Kalergis, we're going to go to you with story number two. This is a piece that you wrote. It appeared in The Real Deal. I'll read you the headline, first couple graphs on it. Any kind of insight you can provide. You might not be able to comment because you wrote about the story. But any insight you could share with the audience would be greatly appreciated. So here we go again. Real Deal. Headline in quotes. Even more difficult. And here's how South Florida's condo buyout landscape will shift following landmark ruling. And a buyout basically is a situation where you take a condominium, you file the paperwork, and lo and behold, that condominium where you have individual unit owners suddenly reverts to one owner and it becomes effectively an apartment building. It's just it's a declaration of condominium. It's handled by the state of Florida. The state of Florida notifies the local property appraiser, and that's what differentiates a condominium from a rental, this declaration of condominium. So simply with a buyout, you rip up that declaration and make it go away, and now you revert back to an apartment, which is nothing changes with the actual structure. It's a legal process. So, going back to your headline, Catherine, even more difficult in quotes. Here's how South Florida's condo buyout landscape will shift following landmark ruling. And here's a subhead. Condo associations may have to secure buy-in from majority or all unit owners before developers will consider these deals, insiders say. And first couple graphs. The developer of the planned addition residence in Miami's Edgewater is on an unforeseen footing after recent rulings that could cost it millions of dollars and alter the landscape of future condo buyouts and terminations statewide. Two Roads, a Miami and West Palm Beach-based development firm led by Reed Boren and Taylor Collins, completed a bulk $150 million purchase on Biscayne 21, a 13-story, 192-unit building at 2121 North Bayshore Drive in 2022. But the developer's plans to demolish the building and construct the new addition tower is now in limbo after Florida's Third Circuit Court of Appeals this month found that the Biscayne 21 condo declaration gave every unit owner an effective veto over any termination of the association. The appeal court reversed a lower court decision that had denied the plaintiffs, a handful of holdout unit owners, a temporary injunction in their lawsuit against Two Roads Development. Unit owner suit alleges that the developer illegally amended the condo declaration. Wow, Catherine, this could have seismic effects on what's going on in Florida right now with condo buyouts, with terminations, and the looming 2025 deadline where associations have to do their structural integrity studies and then carve out money in the budget in 2025 to actually pay for it. So what can you tell us about it, Catherine?
Yeah, I think what's kind of interesting is this only applies to condo associations where in the declaration, it explicitly said that it required 100% approval to terminate. And it was before the law changed, I think in 1974, I want to say.
Okay.
So, you know, it obviously doesn't mean all buildings, but because it applies to buildings that are generally much older, it's probably the ones that developers are targeting. So essentially, it's hard to get enough buy-in to do these deals anyway. Now developers are probably not going to want to touch those buildings unless they get 100% approval. So it just like really kind of like muddles up that process, but it gives the unit owners more power in blocking a deal and staying in their units. Then you have all the issues that we just talked about with the previous story. All these buildings are much older. They need a lot of, you know, they need more repairs. They're more expensive to maintain. So I think it just makes these deals more challenging. But also, like, the developers, without revealing too much, are trying to fight this. So stay tuned on that.
Catherine, I wonder, when you were reporting out the story, did the developer say anything as How do they go forward? Obviously, they're going to appeal this. But I mean, have they funded the unit owners who are in agreement thus far? And then how do you get your money back? And if you haven't funded it, where's the cash? Is it sitting in an escrow account? Any kind of detail like that? Yeah. Was that kind of confidential? They didn't share that with you.
So this deal, what's unusual, I think, about this deal is that the developer closed on the majority of units, paid $150 million for them. Those owners are gone. They've gotten their money. That's done. They started pre-sales for their, over a year ago, pre-sales for their branded luxury condo project. So they're like, that's what I mean in the story by they're on like unforeseen footing or whatever words I use. But it's essentially, I think they if they lose, if they don't get a rehearing, because there's no, the third DCA is kind of like the final thing unless you go to the Supreme Court. So if they don't get a rehearing, they would try to get the Supreme Court to hear it. That's hard to do. They get, I don't know how many requests. So I think they'll probably try to settle with the remaining owners just so they can move on. Otherwise, I don't really see what other option they have. But I'm not getting any indication from either side that there is a settlement at this point.
Interesting. Now, Kathy, you reported the story and you're going to be writing other stories, I'm assuming, as we go forward. So let me throw this out to Jean or to Mr. Fackler. Jean or Mr. Fackler, typically if you have a house and the house is in disrepair, the city will notify you and then lo and behold, they'll send in a bulldozer and knock the damn thing down. And then they'll give you the bill. They'll lean it against your property, whatever the case may be. You're still the owner, but they'll lean it against their. Maybe they'll try to sell the property, get repaid, whatever the case may be. I'm not an expert in that, but just talking big picture. So, gentlemen, I'm just wondering if the supermajority of these units were sold to this one developer, which is called, it's called Two Roads, and they decide come 2025 that they don't want to put any money in reserves, and it gets to the point where maybe it actually has to be evacuated and could be torn down for safety reasons. I mean, could you see that as a strategy, or am I mixing apples and oranges here?
I don't know. There's a lot of hypotheticals in there.
It is an unauthorized podcast.
I think the easy way to solve it is what Catherine said, which is you pay the remaining owners more. You pay them to get out. So, I mean, it's just as. It's pretty simple. That everybody's got a price, and I'm sure the remaining owners have a price, and that's probably why they held out. I mean, they didn't hold out, my guess is they're holding out for more money. And of course, with this looming deadline and all these fees, and requirements. I mean, everybody's got to come to some sort of an agreement here because it doesn't make any sense for them to stay. And, the developers just need to pay in a little more and have them go away.
So, Mr. Fackler, let me ask you, if you were somebody, and Catherine mentioned in her story that pre-sales began about a year ago or so. Now there's some question about whether or not this project's going to go forward in terms of the timing. I'm just wondering, Mr. Fackler, if you were somebody who put down cash more than a year ago, now you're reading this headline, you got your cash down. Now, granted, I don't know what percentage of the cash was put down, but it's the addition, so it's a name brand. What would you do if that were you, Mr. Fackler?
Well, let's point out, it's probably a large amount of cash. These are name brands. Part of this whole deal starting years ago with the cash down was you got to put a certain amount of cash down. And I don't know what the number is here, but if I put a lot of cash down in this, I would be livid. I don't know, what are you going to do? You're trapped. You're going to be tied up in litigation if you fight it. You would probably have to, like Jean said, hold out for the most money you could possibly get because that's you're stuck. I mean,
or just to throw it out there to the floor, or what you do is if this Two Roads group actually acquired a supermajority of the units, but not enough to get over the one vote veto, why not just jack up the budget in 2025? Because obviously you can vote in whoever you want, make it so cost prohibitive that anybody who's living there, then you can move the foreclose on them for not paying the maintenance fees. Or Jean, is that too many hypotheticals?
Well, there's just a simple way out, which is you just pay the owners more. Obviously that may not be in their budget, but it seems that they lost you know, they lost in court, so they gotta come to a settlement.
I will say, not to throw a wrench in the hypothetical, but the building is empty.
Please.
So the AC stopped working last summer. Everybody was out. So there's nobody actually. I don't even think it's livable at this point.
Wow.
Mr. Fackler, is that a shakedown?
Well, I don't know if it's a shakedown on purpose, but somebody doesn't have the money to pay to fix the AC.
So No. The fact that these people simply don't want to turn it over. They can't live there. They're not living there anymore. So I'm wondering, do you think these people are simply think they can squeeze a little bit more out of this greedy, rich developer, which is the way many of them probably see it?
Absolutely.
Awesome. Good.
Hey, one more question. You mentioned the pre-sales. Now, if you've put cash down for a future unit, doesn't the developer have to perform in a specific amount of time? And is there like an out for those folks who've put down deposits for the units?
They do.
Well, usually there is, right? I mean, I've heard that.
Yeah, don't you think, Peter? That's what I've heard.
Well, I can discuss this. I don't want to do it on the podcast, though, because there's going to be a bunch of attorneys. I don't want to give any kind of legal advice because I'm not an attorney. But there is an avenue, a vehicle that many developers use to go ahead and peddle product. There are some nuances involved with them, is all I'll say. But I'm not an attorney. I'm not practicing law. Check with your attorney.
Thanks, Peter.
you were talking hypothetical.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for not putting us in legal jeopardy.
Exactly.
And if anybody out there is threatening to sue Mr. Fackler, can be reached on X, which is probably Twitter, at JT Fackler, JTFAKLER.
All right, you set me up for that. That question set me up. I didn't realize it.
Let's go on to story number three. Story number three, John Fackler, we're going to go to you. This is a piece that is coming out of the Miami New Times. It was originally reported by Bloomberg. New Times picked it up. So I want to go with more of a local angle. I'm going to read you the headline for a couple of graphs, and I want you to comment. Keeping in mind, about a month or so ago, Wall Street Journal wrote a piece about how AI, artificial intelligence, is a new boom. It's a new wave. It's a new thing. And as a result, many of the people who are working from home who came to South Florida during the pandemic, because they could basically live in a state where you didn't have to wear a mask. You do anything you wanted. If you wanted to twerk on a police car during spring break, you could do it. And so as all these people came here and they were working from home, but they were working for Silicon Valley-based companies, whether they were in California or maybe they were working for companies out of New York. Now what the Wall Street Journal is reporting is a lot of people are getting called back to Silicon Valley because AI is blowing up. So that's the background, Mr. Fackler. So I want you to sort of give your input on this. Again, Miami New Times headline report. Apple chooses Coral Gables for a new Florida office. Here's a subhead. As a national market for office space flounders, Miami-Dade is holding its own for now, lining up marquee tech tenants like Apple and Microsoft. And here we go, Mr. Fackler, first couple graphs, and I want you to comment. Apple Incorporated plans to open a roughly 45,000 square foot office space in Coral Gables Tower, following in the footsteps of other tech giants that are setting up shop in the Miami area, Bloomberg reports. The smartphone maker is poised to move into the Plaza Coral Gables, a newly constructed mixed-use complex in the City Beautiful. Apple reportedly has a lease for the upper floors in the Plaza's North Tower, one of two towers with expansive office space in the complex. BizNow reported that the deal is one of the largest Miami area commercial leases inked in 2024. Mr. Fackler, why don't you give us your perspective about Apple coming, the timing of them coming. Why did they go to Coral Gables, which, if anybody doesn't know, is a suburb of Miami? It's a little bit highbrow. It does have closer proximity in terms of travel time to Miami International Airport. But what's your take, Mr. Fackler?
Well, one thing about the move to Gables. Gables, of course, as we know, is pretty highbrow, expensive rents. However, it's cheaper by a long shot than being on Brickell. Now, Brickell was the area where a lot of the tech bros went and set up shop. You had the collapse of FTX.
Crypto currency exchange.
Yes.
Where Sam Bankman-Fried, the founder, was just sentenced to 25 years for fraud and a variety of other things. And by the way, the name of the arena where the Miami Heat plays was called the FTX arena. Yes. Anyways, go ahead, Mr. Fackler.
Yeah, so this tech investment, which really started, during the pandemic, a little bit post-pandemic, was led by Bezos, Ken Griffin, Peter Thiel. So it looked really good on the surface. So they were going to be able to attract a lot of workers, tech workers here, which never really materialized. What I'm saying is you got a lot of pluses and minuses going on here, a lot of transitions. One of the nuggets that I found in this story, which I found shocking, and I think Jean would find shocking, she's talked about the office vacancy rate. Do you know that Miami has a office vacancy rate of only 10%, which is, you know, I mean, I never thought that shocked me. I thought there was so much office space that they'd be, you know, be able to drop prices and, you know, people will be moving back. They would be able to attract companies from Silicon Valley, so to speak. But, you know, they really apparently they've been holding their own as far as the office.
But Mr. Beckler, I'm more interested in Apple. What does it mean for Apple to come here? Is that a big deal? Is it not a big deal? And they use the opportunity from the fact that office space is struggling around the country to go in and maybe negotiate a sweetheart deal.
Well, that's what I was saying. I said that because Coral Gables is cheaper than Brickell, why not go to the Gables and set up shop in a nice place? I think it's the top three floors of one of the office buildings there. And by the way, Gables is not cheap as far as commercial goes. It's about 30% more than the average. So, but it's still cheaper than Brickell. So maybe they're, like you said, they're trying to make a deal.
Jean or Catherine, Apple stock is getting hammered because it doesn't have an AI play. Wall Street Journal reported a month ago or so that all these Silicon Valley companies, whether it be Microsoft or Google or anybody else, they actually brought the founders of Google back out of retirement, trying to get their AI game together. What do you guys make of the fact that Apple's taking this space when everybody's going back to Silicon Valley? Does Apple know something we don't, or are they simply behind the curve?
Well, Peter, 45,000 square feet is nothing. I mean, it's a little dinky drop in the bucket for a company like Apple that has millions and millions of square feet of
$96 billion dollars in annual net income for Apple, according to the story.
Okay, so this is a little rinky-dink office. I mean, seriously, in the great big scheme of things, I mean, Apple's a big name. And yeah, it's a big deal to have them here, but honestly, I mean, this is really a tiny office. The other thing I was going to say about Coral Gables is it's closer to the University of Miami. And my thinking was, well, initially it was, why would they go to Coral Gables? Well, you know, they would be close to the University of Miami, where they might be able to tap into some tech talent from the students and university there. So you know, that was kind of my thought with that. And of course, if they're like higher paid executives, you know, the Gables is definitely the place to be. What were you going to say, Peter?
Well, what I was going to ask is, if this is a SPAC, this is nothing. $96 billion in net income, I think is what the number was. Why the hell are we making such a big deal down here about Apple coming then?
Well, because the politicians love it and the Chamber of Commerce loves it.
But I didn't see any of them. I didn't see the Beacon Council. I didn't see Enterprise Florida. I didn't see anybody talking about how they got Apple here.
Yeah, but it's rah-rah, like Apple's here. We're kicking Silicon Valley butt. You know, it's like, I think there's a lot of media hype. There's a lot of sort of, a lot of sort of that kind of buzzy hype going on. And
yeah, on that point, they also mentioned that they're opening a very large retail center in World City Center, which I think the square footage was bigger than the office building. I'm not sure. I have to check. So they're working it right now. They're working the PRs.
Catherine, give us your take. I want a critical eye. What say you?
I agree with you guys. I think it was overplayed in the media. I'm a reporter, so I get it. But people love to read about Apple. You know what I mean? They do. And also, I will say, I don't actually think, because I had heard about this late last year, I don't think that this was signed this year. I don't know that for sure, but I'm pretty...
Nice.
I just feel like it's kind of a little bit late. I wasn't able to confirm it, but... You know, I think it's overplayed.
Interesting. Jean Gruss, let's go to you with story number four. Jean Gruss, this piece is coming out of Bloomberg. I'm going to read you the headline first, couple graphs, and I want you to comment. Headline, bond traders are preparing for a 5% yield, no rate cut world. And here's first couple graphs. Bond traders are readying for 10-year U.S. Treasury yields surpassing 5% as a scenario of no interest rate cuts by the Federal Reserve this year looks increasingly possible. And to give everybody context, going into 2024, there was talk that we could have as many as 6 rate cuts. Now they're talking about 2 or 3 rate cuts. And this story is indicating we might actually see rates going up. So a story goes on to say Schroders PLC is shorting U.S. bonds across some tenors as sticky inflation raises the risk of higher for longer rates. Pacific Investment Management Company expects the Fed to ease policy at a more gradual pace than peers in other developed markets with a non-negligible chance that it doesn't cut at all. John, what's going on? Everybody thinks the stock market is what drives the world. It's actually the bonds that drive the world. So what's your take on it as a former banking reporter?
Yeah, and we were just talking about this on last week's episode, that the Federal Reserve is just, you know, they don't seem to know what they're doing. I mean, we went from like 7 cuts to none in like a matter of like a couple months. I mean, how does that happen, you know? They haven't licked inflation like they thought they would. And yields are going to remain high. And I think, you know, that's going to cause some pain going forward, particularly in the commercial real estate market as investors have to renew their loans. And that's going to create some real hardships, I think. The thing is that, you know, the bond market reacts to what the Fed says, and the Fed has been sending mixed messages, and they've been stampeding in and out of the 10-year bond like crazy. I mean, the 10-year bond, 10-year treasury bond is sort of the benchmark rate for so many of our financial products, and so many of our mortgages related to real estate, commercial and residential. You just can't mess around with it, and these wild swings in a 10-year the 10-year bond, or it's really creating a lot of chaos in the market. And the outlook earlier this year that we would be getting a bunch of rate cuts, you know, is really and now we're not going to get any. Maybe, I mean, that's screwing everybody's you know, plans. You just I think it's really irresponsible to be sort of creating this chaos in the bond market, these wild swings of investors piling in and piling out, you know, of treasuries. It's really amazing. I don't think I've seen it in like 30 years I've been covering finance. This kind of volatility is going to create some real problems, I think.
No, Mr. Griff, just to lay it out for the audience, you know, people who don't really give rat's ass too much about it, but so we can put it in their terms. Basically, the 10-year treasury, a bank will put like, what, 3 points on it for a mortgage? Is that fair? So if it's coming in at 5, then your mortgage would be 8?
Exactly.
Ballpark? Okay. Yeah. And then generally speaking, when the Federal Reserve, the central bank, when it cuts interest rates, housing tends to go up because stuff's cheaper. And when it raises interest rates, housing tends to slow down because everything costs more. Am I getting that right, Mr. Gross?
Yeah, I think you can say that.
Okay, so if we're looking at a 10-year treasury approaching 5, today when we're recording, it's coming at a 4.6. That means rates are going up. So that would, in theory, mean this could be bad for housing.
I mean, we could go back to 8% or more mortgages. I mean, we're at 7.5 now on average. You know, 8 is not that far away. Of course, we had 8 last year.
We did.
So we did see, could go higher. I mean, I think we talked on the podcast last week, JP Morgan was talking about 8% rates. And so, yeah, we, you know, it's anybody's guess right now.
Catherine, you're the residential bureau chief over at The Real Deal. Have you heard anything from any of your sources or reporting out stories? What impact are people, are they concerned that mortgage rates could hit 8% if the 10-year treasury actually hits 5? Any thoughts?
Not really. I mean, a lot of my sources are real estate agents, and they don't talk about that. So maybe they probably are concerned.
They probably are concerned. Interesting. And listen, this is a great segue in story number 5. Catherine Collier, just going to you with story number 5. This is a piece you wrote in The Real Deal. I'll read you the headline. I'll read you the first couple of graphs, and I want you to comment. And the headline is, South Florida brokers predict a survival of the fittest following the NAR settlement. NAR is the National Association of Realtors. Anybody doesn't know, they got sued. The NAR, as well as a bunch of different big brokerages, they got sued because the way, and this is layman's terms, the way it works is if you get a real estate license, you go in and you join a club. Club is called the Realtors Club. And in joining it, for in Miami, it's like $1,000 a year. You get to play on this database, which is called a listing service. So if you're a golfer, you join a country club so you can play the golf courts. If you're a sailor, you join a sailing club so you can dock your boat. And if you were somebody with a real estate license, you join the Realtor Club so you get to use this MLS, this database. And what the MLS does is it gives anybody who puts something in there the ability to market their information everywhere. Zillow taps into it. Realtor.com taps into it. Everybody else taps into it. But the rule is, or it was before this settlement came out as a result of the lawsuit, is anything that's offered in there, you have to offer a commission to the other side of the deal. Now, as part of this proposed settlement that could go into effect in July, assuming a judge signs off on it after a lawsuit, you can now can put something in the multiple listing service, the database, and you don't have to pay a commission to other members of the club, which is the Realtor Association. So what does that mean in basic terms? That means before, many realtors, in order to take a listing to sell your home, would offer 6%. They would keep 3% on the sell side, and they'd offer 3% on the buy side. Come July, if the judge approves it, you only have to offer 3%, and that's to the person with the listing. And it might not even be 3%. There might be a competition for the listing, and therefore the commission could be even less. So this means that people could effectively spend less money in doing a real estate transaction. So that's the background. Let me get back into your story, Catherine. Headline, South Florida brokers predict a survival of the fittest following NAR settlement. Subhead, broker revenues will likely drop. The question is how much? And here we go. Craig Sicknicki recognized the value of shaking things up. Some disruptors make a lot of sense for me, like Uber, he said. But the South Florida brokerage chief is scratching his head in response to the National Association of Realtors' proposed settlement of the class action lawsuit filed by a group of home sellers in Missouri. Announced last month, under the $418 million settlement, the industry trade group with nearly 1.5 million members is barring listing agents from offering compensation to buyer's agents through the MLS or the multiple listing service. In other words, the entry field will disappear in the MLS, but a buyer's agent can still pick up the phone and call the seller's agent, find out what the commission would be. And for disclosure, I have a real estate license. I've been licensed since 1995. I work on the buy side. I've always worked on the buy side. I don't like to take a listing. Sellers can be a pain in the ass. They think they got gold when in reality they got like copper. So I work on the buy side. So this for me is good news. So I just wanted to put that out there. Catherine, why don't you give us some more details? Survival of the fittest. It sounds like it's going to be brass knuckles, cage match going on in the real estate industry where we have 62,000 realtors in the Miami Association of Realtors based on what I read recently.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it just kind of, the other headline I was toying with was something like confusion themed because a lot of people I spoke to were either very confused about what this meant or said all they are hearing is questions and trying to kind of clear it up and that kind of thing. It is like the rule change is kind of, you know, I mean, you could still offer buyer's compensation. You just can't put it in the MLS. So I think it like makes everything a little bit more fragmented. It kind of allows for like other you can put the compensation on your website. Do you know what I mean? Like there's other ways to get it. I think that there will be fewer. I think some agents will leave the industry because those will be the agents who don't really add anything. You know, maybe it's like the person who has their license on the side or, you know, something like that.
Yep.
But any brokerage that I'm curious what you think about it, because anyone who focuses on the buy side, it does kind of change the conversation a bit, doesn't it?
Oh, no. This is fantastic news. So let me lay it out there. And I've been a broker since 06 in Florida. I've been licensed since 1995. Now, the question is, the person you're working with, do they know their head from their ass? And many of them do not. They simply don't. And they didn't have to, because under the old rule, you can meet somebody in a bar. You can meet them at church. You can meet them at a flea market. And they want to go see a property. You go, you show them a property. You got a license. And lo and behold, if that person buys or runs the place, you're getting a commission. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to know anything. But when you work with people who are a little bit more, let's say, investor-oriented, meaning they want to return on their money, they're not speculating that Miami's the gateway to Latin America and prices only go up, it's a little bit different type of story. So on my side, I would typically sign people to a fiduciary, a buy-side agreement. So my role is to try to work on their behalf to get the best deal. So, you know, this will be survival of the fittest. And what I will tell you is the industry is based on sell side. It's based on blowing smoke up everybody's ass, telling them how great it is. It's not based on actually running the numbers. We're in April, and there's going to be a halving of the Bitcoin and how much you get back in return. There's going to be a halving of the real estate industry from what I can see, because many people simply aren't equipped to go in there and work on the buy side. They're just used to, you know, being a tour agent, if you will.
Yeah. But how do you kind of account for all of the people who are purchasing property and that's kind of the only time in their lives they're doing it and they don't understand it? And do you know what I mean?
What's so significant about this settlement, if it's approved by the judge and goes into effect in July, is that this will be nationwide. Previously, depending on what state you went through, there were different rules. Now, somebody was telling me that one state, in order to show a property as a buy-side agent, you actually had to have a signed brokerage agreement, and you'd have to send it to the listing agent before the listing agent would open a door for you. In Miami and in Florida, it doesn't work that way. You basically just show up, you know, you let them know what your name is, and everybody kind of works something. So we're actually going to get some real structure to the program. And I think where I'm going with this is, now that it's nationwide, any buyer, it doesn't matter if you're in Ohio, you're in the state of Washington, you're in Washington, D.C., or you're in Florida, we're all playing by the same rules. And this, I think, is going to bring a lot of clarity. Where people come from out of state coming to Florida, they would simply be confused. Now it's going to kind of be across the board, at least in theory.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely do see, though, a thinning of the herd.
Mr. Vackler, previous podcast, you said that you think, based on your research skills, you wouldn't use a realtor to go and buy and lease a place. Are you still of that opinion?
Yeah, I still haven't changed my mind. I still would, you know, I mean, I'm a little different than the average buyer, I think, because of my journalism background and research. So I know, you know, databases and things, places to look. I would probably try to use that to my advantage in this situation.
And Mr. Gruce, you said previously that you pay the 6% commission, 3 to the buy side, 3 to the sell side, because you want to move that property. You're not worried about the nickel and diamond. You simply want that property gone, because markets change. And once they change, it takes a lot to bring them back. So you still have that opinion?
I mean, yeah, if I'm a seller, I want to bring buyers. So yeah, I'll pay the 3% to bring the buyers. What comes to mind is, I remember when home builders during the Great Recession were paying realtors 10% commissions to bring buyers. So, I mean, you know, in a tough market, you want people to bring buyers.
For what it's worth, Miami Realtor Association has somewhere in the ballpark of 62,000 members. I would tell you the dues are about $1,000 a year. You do the math. So you can see if we see a downturn in the number of people in the real estate industry, you know, it's wide reaching effects is what could be coming. So let's go on to Mr. Fackler. John Fackler, we're going to you with story number 6. This is actually coming out of the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Mr. Fackler. I'm going to read you the headline for a couple of graphs, and I want you to comment. Headline. Again, coming out of the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the sun is setting on South Florida's condo retirement dream. And this is an opinion piece by a gentleman called David J. Miller. Here we go. I don't know about you, but my vision of retirement has always involved living in a luxury condominium on a beautiful Florida beach. All of my neighbors in this daydream meet at the pool each day for happy hour at sunset. And there are more smiles and laughs to go around than the afters have and all those big pharma commercials combined. Unfortunately, instead of standard dream of my golden years, I'm now forced to reconcile with the fact that condo living as we previously knew it has changed. After the Surfside condominium tragedy, and that's a tragedy where a tower collapsed on the Barrier Island just north of Miami Beach in south of Sunny Isles Beach. Nearly 100 people died. It was a $1 billion settlement. And the feds are currently investigating as to what caused this, because they don't want this to happen again. So that's the Surfside disaster. So let me continue. After the Surfside condominium tragedy, our state and local leaders took a hard look at aging condominium buildings and what safety measures should be put in place to protect condo residents. Legislation was then enacted that mandates extensive inspections and stricter guidelines for older buildings and those with a close proximity to saltwater. This new legislation and the required inspections were necessary, but this additional due diligence is also expensive. If an issue is found during the inspection that necessitates repairs being made, the cost to complete such a project could easily be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. The story goes on to say, if you're on a fixed income and costs go up or insurance goes up, how are you going to afford it? So what say you, Mr. Feckler? You got here in the 1980s. Why don't you tell us what it was like, what the reputation of Florida was when you got here in the 1980s and kind of where you see going forward from a retirement perspective?
Well, back in the day, I mean, you could find yourself a 55 and over place, and there'd be, you know, not a lot of action, not a lot of up or down in the market. But, you know, one of the things I really found interesting in the story, because he goes into the whole condo termination situation, which may be a rapid development. By the way, the author of this piece is actually a litigation real estate attorney. So he's licking his chops. Apparently, I didn't know this, but each unit owner is entitled to 100% of the fair market value of the apartment, which would be great normally, but it could also cause, you know, major litigation due to the variable values in the building. I mean, you got somebody they're all going to be arguing about how much each unit costs.
My sister-in-law said it's worth this. My brother told me it was that.
He also brings up, plus this fighting over the nuances in a termination agreement. So this guy's, you know, he's licking his chops. He's a litigation attorney. I don't blame him. But, you know, when you look at that and then you have the escalating special assessments, you know, to cover the costs, that's going to also hinder future buyers, I think, as well. Not really talked about it in the story, but it just seems like, you know, it's just like a terrible cycle here with these older buildings. I don't see it getting any better. And also a rush to get everything done, I think, by December of 2024 is one of the deadlines
for doing a structural integrity study.
Exactly.
And the money has to be earmarked for 2025.
Yeah. Right, exactly. The money's got to be earmarked now. So that's been the problem all along. The money wasn't there.
Mr. Feckler, let me walk you back. Anybody of a certain age remembers a show called Seinfeld. And the Seinfeld show, the stereotype was you would retire from New York to places like South Florida. Sure. Jerry Seinfeld, the namesake of the show, his parents were retired to Del Boca Vista. It was cheap. They had Cadillacs. They'd go early bird dinners. That was sort of the reputation of Florida for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Am I summarizing that correct?
Absolutely. And in fact, that is flipped on its head, and which was pointed out in this article, because a lot of people like this, even this gentleman was looking forward to retiring in bliss in Florida. Now he can't do it. He's an attorney. So, I mean, you know, everything is, that whole idea of retiring in Florida on a pension is gone, essentially, unless something dramatic happens in the market.
So Mr. Feckler, play it out with me. Let's say a lot of these older types, you know, they can't afford it. They don't want to afford it. People start to bail on Century Villages or the Village in Central Florida, which is all earmarked towards over 55 communities. Do we have enough people to fill the space? What happens to pricing and where do they go next?
Well, if there's an exodus, there's nobody to fill the space. I mean, if there's really a point where they can't afford it, they're going to move to Carolina, let's say, because they can't afford to live in South Florida. Also, the golf course communities is another question mark. Those were a big draw for, you know, retirees. I don't know what's happening with that market as well. So there's a lot of issues to look at here. And I really think that it's a real question mark.
Catherine and Jean, we got some questions about affordable housing. We had all these relocations from California, New York, a variety of other places. Suddenly, if the senior retirement dream, if that's over, doesn't this housing suddenly become perfectly situated and suited for maybe those people looking for affordable housing? Or am I missing something? Like who fills the space if these seniors on a fixed income, if they can't afford to be here anymore, whether it's South Florida or it's anywhere in the state of Florida? Anybody have any thoughts?
I don't think it becomes, I still think it becomes expensive because you still have to invest in these buildings that are older and the insurance is high and all of this thing. So I feel like, in a way, it's just people are going to try to avoid them because you could rent in something maybe nicer. You don't have to worry about it. I don't know. I don't think that there's like a waiting list of people trying to rush into those properties. Unless it's to buy in bulk and potentially knock it down or rent it out or do something like that.
So I have a couple of observations. The first one being, The first one being, it's like this drumbeat of negative headlines about condos, like on a near daily basis. I mean, that can't be helping new condo sales either. I mean, if I'm looking to invest in a condo, a brand new condo, I know like in 20 years, I'm going to be like paying some major special assessments. I'm looking at like the future, like, yeah. Is this going to be me in 20 years, you know? And then my other observation is, you know, Florida's a pretty big state. I mean, you know, South Florida may be unaffordable now, but there's a lot of parts of Florida that are affordable. I mean, yeah, they're probably more rural inland counties, but I mean, in terms of Florida being dead as a retirement destination, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, you mentioned the Villages. I mean, you know, the Villages is in a very rural area. It's basically, they built the city out of nowhere. If you've ever been there, it's worth a visit. It's just a sprawling community. It's all accessible by golf carts. It's like, and then you, when you buy a house there, you get golf for life for free.
Jean, there's a Netflix series or a Netflix movie, a documentary on the Villages. And I'd encourage everybody to check it out. And although I think it tends to deal a little bit more with the relationships and the different social interaction between the owners and the residents of the Villages. But please continue, Jean.
The Villages is just an example, but what I'm saying is that there's a lot of rural land. There's a lot of areas that are relatively affordable. So I just think that, like, in the desirable areas like Miami or Fort Lauderdale or Naples or, you know, Tampa, you know, you're going to have to pay up. I mean, that's just a reality now, but there are many, many parts of Florida that have very affordable prices still.
Interesting. Very affordable prices. I want to go ahead and thank the members of the podcast this week. I want to thank Jean Gruce. He was a journalist for over 25 years. Right now, he does public relations marketing. Has his own firm. It's called Gruce Communications. You can check out his website, GrucePR.com. You can also get him on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at Jean Gruce, JeanGruss. I want to thank John Fackler. John was a journalist for over 20 years. Right now, he does marketing and public relations. You get him on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at JT Fackler, JTFAKLER. And I want to thank Catherine Kalerja. She is a residential bureau chief over at The Real Deal. Catherine's been a journalist for over a decade. You want to get her on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get her at KKALLERGIS. Catherine Kalerja on X. And I'm Peter Zalewski of Condo Vultures. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any comments for us, you like what we said, you don't like what we said, get us on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get us at Miami RRP, at Miami RRP, which stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. It's not AARP, it's Miami RRP. And don't forget to check out my website. I'm the sponsor, condovultures.com. And until next time, take care of yourself, and we'll catch up real soon. Ciao, ciao.
It's a simple formula, and it works. Buy low, sell high. We're Condo Vultures, and when it comes to your real estate, we help you buy low. At Condo Vultures, we represent the buyer, and now's the time to buy. Log on to condovultures.com for more information, condovultures.com. And remember, before you sell high, you have to buy low. Featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, 60 Minutes, and Time Magazine. Condo Vultures Realty, a licensed Florida real estate brokerage capitalizing on the condo correction since 2006.
This is Peter Zalewski of the Condo Vultures podcast. Before I started doing these podcasts, I've been in the business of being a licensed real estate broker, a contributing columnist for the Miami Herald, as well as the Miami Real Deal, but also extra witness work in consulting. So if you are looking for an expert witness, or if you're looking for consulting services, a straight talk perspective as to what's going on in a particular marketplace, a building, or what happened previously, for whatever your situation is, whether you are an attorney, whether you are an institutional fund looking to invest, or whether you're a lender who's trying to come up with some sort of a strategy and approach for your lending committee going forward, I don't just might be able to help you. To get a hold of me, please reach out to peter@condovultures.com. That's peter@condovultures.com. Or give me a call to the office at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859.